Maybe second to Hobbs Island?
Thank you, Chairman Cox, and good evening, everyone. I'm going to give you some updates and make my report a tad short tonight because I want to give my time to Scott Ferguson, who will be coming behind me to speak on the quarterly violations report, and he will give you a bonus annual violations report for the whole year. Let me give you a few updates that are in your packet, and that's in the EO report, so I'll start there. One of the first items, item number one, bait stamp 5-4, is the swamp program. And I also wanted to note that the executive summary of the swamp statewide swamp report, which is the statewide ambient monitoring program, so I won't say acronyms there, contains executive summary. And our own Tom Sook from our region pretty much wrote that whole report with the other regional boards, but he really played leadership role in that, so I wanted to point that out. SWAMP is a very vital program across the entire state, but it's particularly important in our region where we don't have a lot of discharges like some of the other regions have to gather monitoring data. So, you know, in layman's term, it's the only game in town for us in many cases, the swamp programs where we collect information on ambient reports, ambient water, surface waters. We have a shoestring budget in our region of a little over $250,000, and that's to cover over 700 lakes and 3,170 miles of streams, just to give you a sense of the magnitude. But with that shoestring budget and with the help of all of our staff, all the staff in both offices often pitch in on that program, it's been a successful program for us over the years. And the reason I bring it up is that report is ways to improve the program. And if you read the executive summary, I'll just give you a few just highlights of the report's recommendations. And that is that a robust ambient water quality monitoring program needs to be maintained. It really is a vital part of our state's infrastructure to have an ongoing ambient monitoring system for surface water. It is severely underfunded. I just gave an example of how it's so underfunded, but it's not just our region, the other regions as well. And that there's value in doing both statewide and regional assessments under the SWAMP program. Another recommendation is that we need to coordinate better with all of our other programs, both internal and external, with other state agencies and federal and local agencies, and find better ways to use our data, like the seeding program, basically update our databases and make it more user-friendly, both uploading and for the public to access it. We also, another recommendation is to develop an annual plan to align SWAMP with other management priorities and available funds, so that what we're looking for in ambient monitoring will help us give us the answers we need for regulatory decisions or statewide policy decisions. We just need to kind of mesh those two efforts better. Another recommendation is to set outcome-based performance measures on the swamp. We also need to improve our internal process for feedback loops and then coordinate amongst the state and regional boards. Do some internal procedures to make the program work better internally. So those are just a few highlights of the SWAMP report, but I did want you to know how important it is to our region and a big role that Tom Sook and some of the other staff who play, not just in our region, but for the state. I'm now going to shift to a different area, and that's my cows and livestock area, and that's item two. And it's regarding, and there you'll see a report of staff who attended a rangeland event. I also attended, there was a sticky rangeland science symposium at UC Davis last week. About 250 cattle ranchers and government officials and others attended this event. And the purpose of it was to kind of learn about some more recent rangeland science and what does it mean in terms of livestock grazing, predominantly focused on cattle. What are some of the new VMPs? What are some of the innovative ways that local governments or conservation districts work with ranchers to both secure their land for the next generation as well as protect water quality? They also talked about a lot of industry challenges and trends, you know, how the younger generation is trying to step up to replace. So, you know, it's a cattle ranching for the most part in California is a family business. It's passed on from family member to family member. I spoke on the status of the Grazing Regulatory Action Project, where we were in the process, that we concluded our listening sessions, that we had heard a lot of concerns from the ranching and, you know, various folks. I summarized for them many of the concerns that were raised, and those are also included in my EO report this month to kind of read through some of the main themes of what people said. And I let them know that no decision had been made. I'm at the stage now where myself and Phil Crater, the co-lead, will be briefing the state board members on what we learned and various options going forward. So an option could be to proceed with the statewide program. Another option could be to not proceed with the statewide program and go back to the way it was with each of the regional board programs, but perhaps spend some time updating the BMPs, because the last round of them were in 1995. That's a bit ago. And perhaps we could all look at the regional board tools and ask ourselves which tools work better and where can we fine-tune our tools. So these, you know, I just gave you a summary. Some of the options we'll likely be presenting to the state board members to see how they would like to proceed on this. The next item I want to update you on is item number 8. This is the Leviathan Mine Settlement Agreement. I think I've told you about 5 or 6 times over the last 2 years that the settlement is near, and soon they will sign it. But I feel pretty confident that we're going to get this done soon, partly because I signed it this morning. So now we're waiting for others to sign it. So I'm hoping the final document will be released. In our item later today with Lori and I, we'll talk a little bit about Leviathan, and so I will keep you interested in listening to that later on. Item number 14 in your EO packet, date stamp 5-16, is an update from our Victico office on their efforts with LADWP. And I think it shows good progress in there about us working with them and having a path forward. And so I just, you know, kudos to the Victorville office staff for having worked so well with LADWP to do that. But we continue our work with them. We are talking about doing quarterly meetings. Our next one, we hope to schedule sometime in April-ish in Bishop to talk about the results of the Bishop Creek monitoring. As you recall, this past summer, they had bacteria problems and they had coast warning signs for the swimmers. So we need to compare all of our data and all the work that we've been doing and then figure out a path forward. We're going to talk some more about the general permit that we might develop with them. There is going to be a presentation in June, the board and Bishop, on the Mono Lake status, and we're going to invite them to participate in that process. And employee training. They're very interested in us collaborating with us about training their employees and some of the rules and requirements. We've done something similar like that for the Forest Service, so we'd like to do that. Let me give you some updates. I'll start with good news, and then on the next one's going to be a little bit of bad news. The good news, Taylor Currier in our TAW office has accepted a position as an environmental scientist for the Nonpoint Source Unit in South Lake Tahoe. Taylor has been a volunteer in the scientific aid for us up here for about a year. He filled a term position by Lori Screed. Lori Screed was out on an extended maternity leave. So rather than leave the dollars on the table, and Lori will tell you more about that later, we've decided to hire someone, even though it's a short term until June. It's a great opportunity for him and great for us, so we welcome Taylor. Now to the bad news. Our green Jeep was stolen out of our parking lot, and we still don't know where it is. Maybe that's not such a bad thing. It had 130,000 miles on it, but maybe we'll get a new car and a deal. But I still, it's not the first time we've had problems with our vehicles. Last year, our cars here in Tahoe were vandalized, and the Victor office has had numerous incidents of problems of vandalism with their cars, including people, and then they have people climb through locked cages to get to the cars. So, anyways, maybe we'll get a new car out of the deal, so that wouldn't be so bad. The next one is electronic content management. We're coming into the electronic century now. We're one of the last regions to convert to, I'll call it ECM, Electronic Content Management. This will be a paperless office system. Will reduce paper use, increase efficiency, and allow staff and the public to view documents. I-signed letters will be sent out shortly to all of our dischargers, asking to submit documents to us electronically by starting May 1st. Our system will switch over both for Victorville and Tahoe May 1st, and our staff are now in various stages of getting trained to get prepared for the system. We, of course, will work with dischargers as to be practical and large documents and maps and you know, members of the public who want to have paper copies, but we're trying to do better in terms of this paperless office, and this should improve efficiency. Underground storage tanks is my next update I'm going to give you. I started my career at the Waterbird, I won't say how long ago, when the underground storage tank program first started, and I recall statewide, I think we had over 300,000 leaking underground storage tank way back when. And much has happened, and I think we sometimes forget about the progress we've made and the important changes that have happened. Both Santa Monica and Lake Tahoe, and if you recall, were ground zero for MTBE pollution. That's where some of the earliest cases were discovered and where people were really upset about it a long time ago. Here's the good news I want to report. In the 80s, when we had such a high number of tanks, we had a number in our region, including some nearby, near the Y. I signed off this week on a cleanup of the USA gas station. This is on Emerald Bay Road for our low threat policy. It's been many years, but it's a good success to say we finally have closed one of our worst sites. This site was underground tank case number 11, to give you an idea of how old this case is, making one of the oldest tank cleanups in our region. In the 1990s, the MTV plume down there, and for those of you who are heading out of town, it's gas station on the right, next to Burt's, the diner Burt's. If you drive out of town, you'll notice it. So the plume was almost 2,000 feet long, and it polluted or threatened six municipal water supply wells. We worked with the local water district to clean up the site. We issued multiple cleanup and abatement orders and ACLs back of the day. And the responsible party cleaned up the site. And the closure of this case, it felt good to sign up a week or so ago. You know, I guess it's the end of an era for us. But I wanted to raise it to just as thanks to all of our staff. You know, these sites have been cleaned up by themselves. Staff worked pretty hard on these sites to clean up. We have underground storage tank unit that you often don't see these things come before you as a board, but I just wanted you to know that's an important program, and that's a big milestone, I think, for us as a board. That's going to conclude my updates to you, because I wanted to now hand it off to Scott to give you the enforcement work. Do you have any questions on any of the items I covered?
Any questions? In the site that was just recently cleaned up,
yeah.
What was the contaminant? MTBE?
It was fuel. I mean, it was a gas station. It had MTBE in the fuel. The normal stuff that's in the underground storage tank, benzene, xylene, all those.
Okay, thank you.
Fun chemicals.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Good evening, members of the board. My name is Scott Ferguson. I'm a supervising water resource control engineer on your staff. And I'm in charge of overseeing the regulatory and enforcement division. And this evening, I would like to spend just a little time with you going over our quarterly violations report for the fourth quarter of 2014. And I'm going to follow that up with a little broader look our violations and enforcement data for the entire year of 2014. So let's talk briefly about the violations entered into our CWITS and SMARTS databases for the fourth quarter. We had a total of 75 violations, and this is at the high end of the range that we saw for 2014 on a quarterly basis. However, out of those 75, 27 were linked to one facility for daily flow limit violations, and that facility being Death Valley National Park's Stovepipe Wells Wastewater Treatment Facility. You take those 27 violations out that were happening on a daily basis, as opposed to some of our other violations, which are more on like maybe a weekly or a monthly or quarterly basis. You take those 27 out, and that brings us down to 48, which ties us for the low of the year on a quarterly basis. And the average was right around 60 for the year. One thing I'd like to point out, we have different classes of violations, class 1, 2, and 3, class 1 being the most egregious. We have a newcomer to our class 1 violation facilities, and that is, I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, Ducommun Aerostructures in El Mirage. And we have groundwater pollution there with nitrates, chromium, and VOCs. And the Water Board's role in enforcement on this case is a little different than you're used to. And that's because DTSC, or the Department of Toxic Substance Control, is the lead agency on responding to the groundwater pollution. And we're playing more of a coordinating and consulting role with DTSC than the lead on enforcement, as we do with many of the cases that you see in our quarterly violations report. Therefore, the quarterly violations report does not, in this case, and likely will not, have any enforcement actions linked to it. Now or in the future. However, that does not mean things are going unresolved out there. Under DTSC's oversight, the discharger has been providing replacement water to nearby residents whose drinking water wells have been adversely affected. They've started expanding their site investigation activities along with their groundwater treatment activities. And this type of information is being captured within our CWITS database. Looking at our Class 2 violations, again, this is where the 27 flow-related violations came in, and those Class 2 violations were dominated by those stovepipe well wastewater treatment facility violations. Those are currently being addressed through a notice of violation, one of our informal enforcement actions. And the remainder of the Class 2 violations, they're spread out among a variety of different facilities and projects. And as staff's cover memo to the quarterly violations report indicates, roughly 80% of those Class 2 violations are being addressed either through informal enforcement or discharger initiated corrective actions or a combination of both. So that's a pretty good response rate on our moderate violations. And then just to wrap it up, for our Class 1, and in this report we had 4 of them, I believe, all of those are being addressed by formal enforcement action by the Water Board, or as in Ducommun Aerostructures case, under DTSC oversight. That's about what I have on the quarterly violations report. Are there any questions on that before we move on?
Yes. Could you explain how it is that DTSC took the lead for that Ducommun Aerostructures incident?
I'm not familiar with the exact process on when DTSC does take lead. Possibly, Michael, please.
I can have a little bit of
okay.
Go to this.
Thank you.
This is not a new case. It's been going on for, I want to say, probably 2 decades.
Okay.
It has. In fact, so there's a hexavalent chromium problem. I think back in the early 2000s, late 90s, there was a public meeting. DTSC was involved in that. They held the public meeting, actually. And we were involved with them as well, because we had the facility that we regulated was a surface impoundment under Title 27, that leak, that had some issues with some chloride, or chloride and some other constituents, probably the chromium as well. And then there are some tanks that are in the facility that had TCE, a solvent, that was released to groundwater. So DSC got involved from the TCE aspect, regulating the facilities within the plant. We got involved with dealing with the other things, and the nitrate came later on. It's a complex kind of facility, but DTSC kind of took that role, and we, and resources as well, we backed off and let them develop a plan to go forward with DUCOM. And DUCOM has been working well with DTSC and has also provided bottled water to the community. There's not that many people getting it right now because there's not that many families or domestic production wells that are influenced by the plume or plumes. So we're working with them right now. They've actually solidified the plan to go forward, at least to deal with the TCE and also to deal with the, actually just the TCE, the fluoridated solvents are what they're working on right now. Hexchrome and nitrates are kind of ancillary. Those will be dealt with in the same token. And we're working really to kind of focus on what that's going to look like, because that's the one drawback of the plan right now. If that helps to clarify.
What do they fabricate?
It was a good question. It was a facility that was aeronautical engineering type of facility. So that's about as much as I know about that.
Okay.
If I give some context, back in the day, whenever toxic used to regulate fetal Wheaton regulating facilities for operation, they tended to default to the cleanup to take care of it too. Mm-hmm. You know, back then. In the 80s, they started, and, you know, same thing with the waterboard back in the day when the waterboard had really kind of defaulted that way. And in the 80s, they started sorting some of them. Mm-hmm. You take this one, I take that one. And on brownfields, they did that too. So a lot of it's just sort. Who got what?
Any other questions? Thank you, Scott.
Go okay. Ahead. So let's turn our attention to the entire year. And by when I refer to 2014, I'm talking about the calendar year. And during the 2014 calendar year, I'm going to provide individual data in addition to some comparisons to previous years, the previous couple of years of 2002 or 2012 and 2013. So this year, we had 416 total violations entered into CWIC's and SMART databases. And this is down significantly from the 887 violations in 2012 and the 716 that we entered in 2013. So we're making significant progress on the compliance front. And as you can see, our enforcement activity has remained relatively constant over the past 3 years, and maybe we're starting to see that pay dividends. So, and then digging down into the details a little further, looking at our different violation classes and how our violations divide among them, you see we have class 1, 2, and 3, and that's class 1 being our most egregious persistent type of violations, such as where we get groundwater pollution that does have an actual effect on drinking water supply. Class 2 are our more moderate. Those can be more our reporting type. We can see exceedances of receiving water objectives in those cases, but in those class 2 cases, typically we don't have any receptors affected. That's sometimes what distinguishes class 1 from class 2. And then class 3 are minor, late reports, isolated incidences and minor exceedances. And then I discovered another one, unclassified. And this, we're doing good this year, as you can see, the light blue is 2014. But the unclassified are those violations that have been put into CWIPs or SMARTs, but did not get classified as 1, 2, or 3. So we have a little data cleanup to do going back for a couple of years. Let's see. The big story here is you can see the majority of our violations are in the moderate category. And again, as we discussed about the quarterly violations report, We have about an 80% response rate to those between our actions and discharger's actions. And we're close to 100% on our class one. So we're getting to the lion's share of our violations. Let's look at the types of violations we saw in 2014 and what dominated them. As you can see here, effluent violations were significant, made up a significant percentage of our violations. This is partially inflated by two facilities, wastewater treatment facilities, again, daily flow limit violations. And the one we've already discussed, Stovepipe Wells, wastewater treatment plant in Death Valley. And the other one was Eastern Sierra CSD's wastewater treatment plant. They had a string of effluent violations related to flow. Both of them are being addressed currently under informal enforcement. And it could develop into something more if the solution involves a lengthy solution, or if financially it's going to be a significant financial commitment for upgrades or whatever, but we're still working through that with the dischargers. The next significant piece of the pie here were groundwater receiving water limitation violations. A lot of these were related to wastewater treatment discharges to pond systems or infiltration systems, such as Barstow. We're guaranteed 12 monthly violations from Barstow because nitrates, they're persistent. It takes a long time to clean up. Barstow's under a cleanup and abatement, or a couple of cleanup and abatement orders to address that, and working with staff on addressing that situation, but it takes time. Other causes, some of our dairies in the past and currently, landfills make up a significant percentage of those groundwater receiving water limitation violations. Again, you're looking at chemicals that once they get in the water, they're difficult to remove, and they're persistent, and it takes time. So a lot of these receiving water limitations are cases that we've been dealing with and will continue to work with for quite a while into the future. And with the landfills, I believe in almost all, if not all, cases, we are working under the Title 27 program, which under a regulatory framework implements evaluation monitoring and corrective actions, so you don't see the enforcement actions linked in our quarterly violations report because it's handled under the regulatory umbrella rather than the enforcement. That's just how that system's set up. Let's see. A couple more just to point out. The DEF, a little typo, a mistake there, that actually refers to deficient reporting, so incomplete self-monitoring reports. And then order conditions, another significant piece of the pie, that can be something such as maintaining minimum freeboard levels. It can be time schedules within WDRs or 401 certs, so complete mitigation requirements for 401 certifications, things like that. And then a couple others, just to close it out, BMPs, mostly construction related, but a couple operational, facility operations related there. And late reports, again, self-monitoring reports. So with violations come enforcement. And looking at our enforcement actions, you'll see, looking at the left-hand side of the chart, the first three types, verbal, SELs, or staff enforcement letters, and NOBs, notices of violation, those are our informal enforcement actions. And eyeballing it, I would say, make up about 85% of our responses to violations. And that's consistent with the direction that you've provided us, and that is to respond to our violations with the lowest effective level of enforcement that is necessary to return a discharger to compliance. And that the charts there, or the chart there, bears out that that's where we're putting our energy, I think we do get a great bang for the buck on that. And then we reserve our formal enforcement actions for our most egregious and persistent and serious type. The 13267 order, that's a lot of our investigative work. Once we find violations, have the discharger dig into what's causing it, what's the extent of the impacts, and what are we going to do about it. And then we use our CAOs and our CDOs to implement those work plans to correct the causes or to stop the causes, to clean up the impacts. And then the final one, Administrative Civil Liabilities, both play punitive, play a deterrent to others who might be considering noncompliance in the future. Let's see. So that is a summary of the, in comparison of our violations and enforcement data for 2014 and looking at a couple of other years. Before I wrap things up this evening, I'd like to draw your attention to the table of pending formal enforcement cases, which is base stamp 5-40 in your agenda package. If you look at this table, here you see that there is a flurry of formal enforcement action that is currently underway and that is going to be hitting the street here within the next few weeks. A couple of these may carry over into April, but we're looking at a lot of these to become public. And in the case of B&E, is already public and under review and consideration. One that is not here is some recent activity that the Water Board's prosecution team has entered into, and that is we have a settlement in principle with the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power to address some violations that are associated with unpermitted work that occurred in Lee Vining Creek. And over the next month, we will be preparing a proposed settlement agreement, and we anticipate that that will be released for board and public review in mid-April. And we are hopeful that you find that acceptable. And as Patty already alluded to, we're making progress on our regulatory front with LADWP, and we continue to anticipate that we'll make good progress there, and that hopefully we will not have a repeat of the proposed, what of the conditions that led to the proposed settlement that you'll see in about a month. That completes my presentation. Do you have any questions or what I've presented?
Are there any questions for Sam?
Thank you very much.
Oh. That's okay. My name is Lori Kemper for the record, and I just wanted to add, I guess we have a couple of formal enforcement actions that we failed to get on the table. The other one I wanted to let you know about, because we're making some immediate progress on, is the case of the South Tahoe Laundry Works site, which is an old dry, was a laundromat that had a self-operated dry cleaning machine. There were two of these types of laundromats located at the South Y a long time ago, in the 70s and 80s. And so, anyway, anybody could operate it, and it leaked PCE into the groundwater at South Y. And this fall, we saw some increasing PCE concentrations in the South Y area. And Lisa Dernbach and I met with the owners of the shopping mall, which is the responsible party now, and with the Office of Enforcement and their attorneys. And we've also are working on something different that we haven't done before, which would be a stipulated agreement to provide replacement water to a couple of properties that have high PC concentrations. So they are already working toward providing bottled water, and also they're looking at putting in wellhead treatment for those two properties. And it turns out those two properties had formerly been impacted by MTBE from the Tahoe Swiss Mart, so that years ago, canisters had been installed for carbon filters, so it may be a fairly simple thing to do, but what ended up happening is we were kind of having a pre-enforcement meeting to discuss a draft cleanup and abatement order we thought for public comment to require replacement water, and the attorney said, well, did you guys ever just think about asking us to do this? And we were like, well, you know, everything looks like a nail when you have a hammer. No, you know, we basically just said, well, this is what we do. We do replacement water orders all the time. We issue cleanup orders. We put them out public comment. But they basically said we'd love to do this in a less formal way, but essentially we're looking at this agreement looking just like a cleanup order without it being called that. And essentially they would sign it, and I would sign it, and they would still provide reports to us on the testing that they do and the, you know, maintenance of these systems.
Have we been monitoring the levels of this pollutant for how long? For 20 years
now? Well, yes. We've had there's actually been active remediation going on at the site of pump and treat system and solar vapor extraction. There was a couple of years ago it shut down for a 6 to 9 month period because of maintenance issues. We think that was the period that that some of this contamination got away from them during that time, and then it crossed the Y intersection and impacted these wells. But the way we found out about these particular properties was someone called us with a concern over the way their water smelled or something. So we grabbed a sample and found the high levels of PCE in those wells. They'd been tested years before. Like I said, they'd been in a regular testing program associated with MCE years ago, and I think they'd been part of an initial investigation for PCE, and they didn't have numbers above the drinking water standard, but both of these properties do. One of them is owned. They're both now currently owned by Stanford Camp that has the summer camp at Fallen Leaf, but this is like one's an office and one is a small set of apartments. They might put some of their workers there this summer, just a couple of apartment units. So we're trying to get it all set up because right now that one parcel is not being used. That's going.
Is this one of those contaminants that doesn't really degrade over time?
Not in this environment, it doesn't appear. And it's definitely shut down like Lucan's Brothers Wells on there. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in another item too, about PCE in general. But that's just another item that you'll see that we'll just put out. Not really for formal public comment. It'll just go out, and if anybody objects, obviously we can make modifications in the future. Or if new wells come in, we can address those.
Thank you, Laurie. And we